you thought white supremacists was a U.S. problem, think again. According to the UN, white supremacists and neo-Nazis are becoming a transnational threat. Why would this elevate to a threat level at this point? Another key question, how have the groups taken advantage of the pandemic to boost their support? That's what the UN has said. Just some of the questions we will be asking our guests in this edition of the debate.
The UN Secretary General says white supremacy and the rise of neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat, warning that the coronavirus pandemic is not helping things. Antonio Guterres told the UN Human Rights Council that risk amounts to terrorism.
We must also step up the fight against resurgent neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and racially and ethnically motivated terrorism. The danger of these hate-driven movements is growing by the day. Let us call them what they are. White supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are more than domestic terror threats. They are becoming a transnational threat. These and other groups have exploited the pandemic to boost their ranks through social polarization and political and cultural manipulation.
Guterres did not name any states, but he warned that groups preaching hate are now the number one internal security threat for several countries. The U.S. has been under the spotlight for racially motivated tensions over the past years, more than any other country. Racial tensions simmered under the presidency of Donald Trump, with some months-long protests triggered by the murder of unarmed African-American George Floyd in the hands of white police officers in 2020. Many described it as the most serious social unrest in the U.S. since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But at least for U.S. officials, nothing was as serious as the siege of the Capitol Hill building, but what incumbent President Joe Biden called thugs, insurrectionists, political extremists, and white supremacists. Guterres hinted at the incident when he warned of hate groups being cheered by people in position of responsibility. Trump openly slammed anti-fascist protests against right-wing extremism amid cheers by white supremacists. But he's not the only Western leader to have attempted to bring back pro-racism rhetoric to center stage. Far-right political parties are now a new reality of politics across Europe. The continent has also been struck by neo-Nazi protests. Far-right politics and protests have been taking different forms, with Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands being some of the hotbeds recently. But a few commonalities tie them all together. They attempt to revive toxic notions of white superiority by stoking fear of religious, ethnic, and racial minorities with a focus on Islam, immigrants, and non-whites. That's sugar-coated with models of defense against threats encroaching on what they tend to call accepted Western values. In May 2019, Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini led a rally of his European far-right allies in Milan. There, he vowed to remold Europe by crackdown on immigrants while protecting the perceived European civilization. That was foreshadowed by international gatherings of neo-Nazi groups in Germany, Poland, and the US. Guterres now warns that this is leading to a growing network of hateful ideologies.
Individuals and groups are engaged in a feeding frenzy of hate, fundraising, recruiting, and communicating online, both at home and overseas, traveling internationally to train together and network their hateful ideologies.
The rise of far-right has led to a surge in attacks on minorities in Western countries, including Britain, France, Germany, and the US, where authorities have been reporting hundreds of racially charged attacks on Muslims and mosques for over the past years. During the coronavirus pandemic, such incidents have also taken the new shape of certain restrictions on minorities' access to medical care and vaccines. Warnings like the one from the UN chief have been there for some time, but a problem lingers on in the absence of meaningful action from Western governments.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, editor at Culture Wars online magazine, E. Michael Jones, joins us from South Bend, Indiana. We also have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, E. Michael Jones. And ask your reaction about what the UN has said. Well, what the UN has warned us about, that white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat. Tell us how that has happened, in your opinion, and why has it become a threat now, not before?
Let me begin by saying that in all the years that I've been contributing to Press TV, this has got to be one of the dumbest, most preposterous statements I have ever heard in my life, okay? This is a complete fabrication on the part of the oligarchs to demonize a group of people who are simply trying to stay alive and survive under really horrible conditions. I'm talking about the United States of America. Okay, I'm going to go one step further, and I'm going to say there are no white people in the United States of America. White is a political category that is based on certain characteristics that gets imposed on groups of people for political purposes to demonize them. That's what's going on here. It's that simple. There's no threat in the United States, and there's certainly no international threat. This is pure oligarch speech.
So, okay, pure oligarch speech there, Jonathan Fryer, is what our guest there is saying. And also, if I understood him correctly, he has blasted the statement coming from the UN. In particular, it came from the UN Secretary General that is calling or is making the statement white supremacists in reference perhaps to the U.S. here. Is E. Michael Jones there justified in his anger, I should say?
Well, I listened with great interest to what Michael had to say, but I disagree completely. I think that the UN Secretary General was quite correct. There really is a problem, not only in North America, but also here in Europe. Indeed, European intelligence agencies, including the British MI5, the Internal Intelligence Agency, has stepped up its monitoring of far-right white extremist groups and individuals ahead of the previously the attention focused mainly on Islamist extremists. There really is a problem, and this has got worse during the COVID pandemic. We saw it with the Proud Boys who marched with others on the Capitol Hill last month in Washington. We've seen it here in Britain and in other European countries. And several far-right politicians have taken advantage of the proportional representation in countries like the Netherlands to win seats in the parliament of the different countries. And indeed, Marine Le Pen, the head of the right-wing group, which is overtly anti-Islamic, is highly likely to win at least the first round of the presidential election, though she may be defeated in the second round, thanks to the French political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, E. Michael Jones, the anger that you expressed on what the UN Secretary General has said somewhat parallels what the U.S. President Joe Biden said recently, that white supremacists are the greatest domestic terror threat in the U.S., and calling what people who support them or their ideals demented and dangerous. I'm guessing you don't agree with Joe Biden, do you?
No. The Secretary of the UN got it from Joe Biden. It's obvious. This is the oligarch narrative. Okay, I have a question for my colleague in London. Okay, is Mr. Salvini white?
He would self-identify as white, unfortunately, many of the supporters of the Liga in Italy are supporters of white supremacy. And although the white European might be a broad definition ethnically, it's what people identify as. And in America, there's a group, not just the Proud Boys, other groups who have targeted non-white immigrants, particularly coming from Central America and Mexico, and also Islamic groups. Here in Europe, it's more the Islamic minorities in countries like France and the Netherlands, but they self-identify as white, and quite rightly say there was an awful lot of...
Is he in a...
On Twitter, White Lives Matter, We Matter.
Okay, go ahead, E. Michael Jones.
Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times when the Italians became white. Okay, there was a time here in America when Italians were not white. Okay, now we have a situation where this category of white is being imposed on anybody that the government doesn't like. Okay, so I was involved in this situation here this summer. St. Louis, there's a statue. Everybody's tearing down statues this summer, and there's a statue of St. Louis, the patron of the city. Okay, this statue has to come down. Well, why? I mean, it's not Robert E. Lee. What's going on here? Is St. Louis white? So the man who's orchestrating this campaign says it's white supremacists who are defending the statue of St. Louis. Well, you look into the story, and it turns out those white supremacists are praying the rosary. Is this something that white supremacists do? No, it's something the Catholics do. And so what we're seeing here, the classic example of what I'm talking about, this is identity theft. Anytime you use the word white, you are engaging in identity theft. And so the whole narrative here is, as soon as you identify a group as white, they've lost the battle. Because as soon as you're white, you're racist. And as soon as you're racist, you have no rights. So I entered into this discussion, wrote an article on it. Within hours of posting the article on the internet, this guy, Umar Lee, challenges me to a debate in which I, at the debate, I changed the narrative. So it's not a battle between white supremacists and black people. It's a battle between Catholics and Jews, because the Jews are the only people who are concerned about Louis, the King Louis of France, because he burned the Talmud. This is a type of misdirection that is being orchestrated by the people who run the show now in the United States, and now the idiots who are in charge of the United Nations are too stupid to understand what's going on.
I think we got six topics out of what statements there that E. Michael Jones just made. I'm trying to break that down in my head. I'm having a tough time wrapping my head around some of the things that you said, E. Michael Jones. I'm going to come back to you, though, because I'm going to give the floor now to Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan Fryer, there's a map that has about 20 countries in Europe that have nationalist parties that came into power just very recently. You could talk about, well, gosh, that covers quite a number of countries, Italy, France, Spain, you name it. Why have white nationalists actually struck such a chord with the population itself, at large, I should say, for them to come into power and hold political posts?
Well, because essentially they've been talking to grievances among a certain proportion of white people. But I think we need to make the distinction between white people and white supremacists. Although white supremacists are white as they see it, they are nonetheless very different from the majority of white people who have embraced the multiculturalism of the European and indeed European Union and of the United Kingdom. But what we've seen right across Europe, from Hungary through to Spain and Portugal, is the recent arrival of strong minority opinion amongst white disenfranchised people who feel that they have grievances against the state, either that the state is handling the COVID epidemic badly, or that they ought to get the virus protection, the vaccine, before the minority communities. And we're seeing a very difficult situation here in Europe. As I say, it's definitely happening. It's not a figment of imagination of Antonio Guterres, and it's not even something that's coming originate from the United States, I don't believe. I really think there is a problem here in Europe that's been developing over several years, long before the pandemic began, and which is largely because of the large influx of Islamic migrants to Hungary and Poland and other parts of Europe who came from Syria in particular. And although Germany opens doors and welcome, the right-wing groups in other countries, on the contrary, have been very antagonistic to these new arrivals. And we've seen within the Mediterranean countries, Italy, Spain, and so on, a backlash against these new arrivals, and the backlash against Islam. But I don't agree at all with Michael, who said that this is a Christian or Catholic versus Jews. This is more Christian civilization versus Islamic civilization. For those of Britain, majority, it's not a problem. But for white extremists, it is a problem.
Okay, well, E. Michael Jones, I want to go back to your statements there. And please walk us through, if you can. And the first angle that I'd like to ask you on is your general statement where you said the U.S. is not white. I'm trying to understand why this label white now is being used in your eyes by the government, what the reasons are, the motives behind the government to look at it in the angle and lens that you are. I mean, if you can back that up for us a little bit here.
Yes. The motive is political control. As soon as a group is white, they're bad because they're racist. So if they can get you to identify as white, you already lost. Charlottesville, classic example of what I'm talking about. So what is a white guy? Okay, there are people who identify as white. It's a Protestant, doesn't go to church anymore. Okay, and what I'm talking about now is the real theory of ethnicity. It's a word we have to bring up here. Ethnicity is the antithesis of race in this instance. Okay, and there there's a theory about American ethnicity, and it's called the triple melting pot, sociological theory, that says after generations in America, your ethnicity is determined by your religion. That is what happened in St. Louis. So there are three ethnic groups in America. They're Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. That's your identity. That's your ethnic identity in America. That's what the oligarchs are trying to destroy. That's what I restored when I wrote the article about St. Louis. That's the real dynamic about what's going on here. Whether my colleague agrees with me or not, that's the story in America. It's ethnic. And I'm not white. I'm biracial. I'm Irish and I'm German. Now, how that these things are all being erased in a massive campaign of identity theft.
Well, this brings about the whole notion of going to waste, Jonathan Fryer, of multiculturalism, whether it's religious multiculturalism or any type that would fall under that umbrella, from, as I mentioned, religion to race to you name it. But we're having consequences of tensions, which has amounted to violence and acts such as xenophobia. I mean, that's what happened in Europe, that forced the MEPs in the European Parliament to take firm action against neo-fascist, as they call the neo-Nazi groups. And maybe some people don't know what a neo-fascist group perhaps is. So hasn't the negative notions, what is at the heart of this problem, again, violence perhaps being one of the negative consequences?
Well, I mean, at the heart of the problem is the fact, as the Secretary General of the UN rightly pointed out, the fact that these groups are talking to each other, that Steve Bannon from the United States is in close contact with far-right groups here in Europe, and that European MEPs of different parties have realized that they have much in common, that Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, or the new Vox Party in the Iberian Peninsula, are meeting together and are discussing things together and realizing that they have common cause, which is to attack the white majority from a white supremacist point of view, so that they claim that the white majority is the establishment of Europe. But the white majority is not listening to the white minority, the white supremacists, who argue that the not only is white right, white is best, and that therefore we should be better if you support the white people. And this is a narrative that appeals to certain people, particularly of little education, who have a lot of pressures on them at the moment, particularly during the pandemic. The unemployment rate has risen in Europe as it has in the United States, and not everybody receives the sort of help that is available from the government. And therefore, they are approving this sort of message that is coming across from a minority. It's a minority which has a voice and which is able, through social media these days, to communicate with each other as well as communicate with the general population.
Okay, my final question goes to you, E. Michael Jones. The statement that the U.N. Secretary General has made is in reference to the politicians who have this notion of white supremacy. How can, he said, quote, we need global coordinated action to defeat this grave and growing danger. So what does he propose to do? I mean, what does he have as a game plan, do you
what
think?
What he's got is a worldwide rebellion against the oligarchs. That's what's going on. India is part of this. The yellow vest, Brexit, Trump, all sorts of people are upset with oligarchic rule. These are not white supremacists. I'm trying to tell you, it's their category. If you collaborate by putting this label on people who are upset with the oligarchic rule, you're working for the oligarchs. It's a category of the mind. You should be able to see through this and see the political purpose behind it. If you can't, you're part of the problem.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Very enlightening indeed. Let me thank our guest, editor at Culture Wars Online Magazine, Michael Jones, there with his statements, and author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Pleasure. Talk to us from London. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Ikaba Tafa, my entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu rka'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum wa'f'alu al-khayra la'allakum tuflihun.
O you who have believed, bow and prostrate and worship your Lord and do good, that you may succeed.
Dear listeners, we're now into the 77th verse of chapter Hajj. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu rka'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum wa'f'alu al-khayra la'allakum tuflihun. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and worship your Lord and do good, that you may be prosperous. Now, this holy verse, addressing the believers, states some general and inclusive instructions which protect their religion. It also protects their worldly affairs and will actually make them successful in all circumstances. And by this beauty of conclusion, Surah Al-Hajj ends. At first, the verse points to four important instructions by saying, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, irka'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum waf'alu al-khayr. O you who believe, bow down, prostrate yourselves, worship your Lord, and do good. So, stating the bowing and prostration, two elements from among all the elements of prayer, might be for the sake of their extraordinary importance in this great kind of worship. The instruction of absolute servitude, which has been stated after these two elements, encompasses every worship and devotion. These two ritual acts, bowing and prostration, are among the examples of worship. But in this holy verse, these two acts are mentioned beside the Quranic word wa'budu, which indicates both the importance of the prayer and the importance of these two elements of the prayer. And the verse is actually saying that divine salvation and prosperity is the last stage of perfection of which we must be hopeful when we have fulfilled our duties of worship, when we have fulfilled our benefactions.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So the verse says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu irka'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum, and worship your Lord. The application of the word rabbakum, your Lord, is in fact an indication to his eligibility for being worshipped. The lack of eligibility of other than Him. The reason is clear. He is the only owner. He is the master. He is the Lord. And where the verse says, وَفْعَلُ الْخَيْرُ, it actually envelops any good deed without any condition and reservation. It has been narrated from Ibn Abbas, who said its objective is union of kindred and also nobility of character. Also, Tafsir al-Burhan narrates from Hazrat Musab bin Ja'far, the seventh Imam, who said that the purpose of the Quranic phrase وَفْعَلُ الْخَيْرُ and do good is the act of obedience from Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam next to the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and it is indeed the statement of a lively aspect from this general concept, and it actually does not contradict the other possible cases. Anyway, with all these verses coming to an end, we come to an understanding how important is the idea of polytheism, that so many verses of the Holy Quran are still talking about that, so are still negating that idea of the polytheists. Some verses of the Holy Quran in this chapter talked about the beliefs of those people, but different verses with different reasonings were here to tell us that their idea is devious one, and you will only get to be prosperous only if you bow down, only if you prostrate, or only if you worship your Lord, the One. And all these aside, you will only be prosperous if you do good, and even this doing good alone will not help you, since the only good work which can be counted as a prerequisite for being the prosperous is the one which the light of Iman and servitude is shed on. Because the verse says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu irka'u wasjudu, and after that, waf'alu al-khayr. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
As the coronavirus resurges in Iran, domestic biotech firms are in a race against time to get a vaccine to the market. Among the 8 viable candidates, Coviran is now ahead in the race. Produced by the headquarters for executing Imam Khomeini's order, the vaccine started its first phase of the human trials in December last year. And now, as developers say, the first step was a success.
The first phase was to test whether or not the vaccine is safe to be injected to everyone. So we inoculated 56 volunteers in 2 stages, and the good news is no one has displayed any serious side effect as a result of the jabs.
2 more phases are left for the vaccine to get the ultimate approval. In the second phase, 400 volunteers will get the jabs. This time, the aim is to assess how much immunity the vaccine will make against the virus.
In the second phase, we are going to have something like 400 people, 100 between 50 and 75, the average of the age, and the other 300 above 18 and until 50. If we will get emergency permit like other vaccines to combine phase 2 and 3.
While the UK variant of the coronavirus has reached Iran, experts say the Iranian vaccine is effective against the mutated virus.
This vaccine is whole virus that is inactivated. And that's why if there is any more mutation in the virus, this whole virus vaccines may be more effective than those that have just a simple antigen or whatever.
Earlier this month, Iran unveiled another homegrown vaccine dubbed CovPars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. Administered through injection and inhalation, CovPars is an mRNA recombinant vaccine that reconstructs a harmless piece of the virus's spike protein. The second batch of Russia's Sputnik V arrived in Iran last week amid an ongoing voluntary vaccination in the country. Iran's government says it does not favor Iranian vaccines over foreign counterparts, and the priority is to start the nationwide vaccination campaign as soon as possible.
Now that the Coviran vaccine has proved safe for mass vaccination, the next step is to test its efficacy. Experts say this will be made clear in the second phase of the human trial, which will kickstart in almost a month. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian refugees in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of UNRWA aid distribution centers against cuts to vital services and assistance by the UN agency. UNRWA provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. As of Sunday, UNRWA implemented further aid cuts to Palestinian refugees, citing budget deficit, but Palestinians maintain that cuts are merely political.
These cuts are purely political and have nothing to do with a budget deficit. Palestinian refugees will continue to fight these conspiracies against the Palestinians and their rights until we achieve the right of return. UNRWA must stop these measures that aim to undermine the issue of refugees and the Palestinian cause.
The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis deepened after former U.S. President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
UNRWA has been cutting back its services over the years. What they gave us today is not enough to feed our families. Every time we get less food items. Today they gave me a small bag of sugar, which is barely enough to make tea for a few days. We are extremely poor and we want UNRWA to restore all of our food aid in order for us to survive.
The vast majority of Gazans are refugees who were kicked out of their towns and villages upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948. Palestinian refugees who suffered for more than seven decades say UNRWA cuts will only increase their plight amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The cuts come at a time that Palestinian refugees are suffering the worst humanitarian conditions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. UNRWA must increase aid instead of cutting it. Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip are extremely poor and are the worst hit by these cuts.
Over 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip, and their hardships have increased under the Israeli blockade.
Palestinian refugees say that as long as they are displaced and dispossessed, UNRWA should provide them with all due services without any cuts. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held a press conference aimed at expressing their refusal of the recent normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The conference comes as a code of ethics for Palestinian journalists and media institutes to stress their rejection for normalizing ties with Israel.
We condemn the recent normalization of ties with Israel. We held this conference as a code of ethics for journalists and media institutes to reveal the Israeli violations and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The normalization of ties remains a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
A number of Palestinian leaders, activists, and journalists attended the conference and condemned establishing Israeli relations, stressing that no deal can bring peace to Israel in the West Asia. Palestinian journalists and activists added that media has a significant role in conveying the true image of the inhumane Israeli regime and refuse any normalization of ties with Israel in terms of media.
Normalizing ties with Israel is a way to justify the inhumane nature of Israel. The recent normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, and we won't accept any recognition of Israel at the expense of Palestinians.
Palestinians call on Arab and Muslim nations to end these normalization of ties with Israel that aims to demolish the historical Palestinian cause.
Palestinian activists are all united to say that normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of all Palestinians. Media should stand against these attempts to demolish the Palestinian cause. All Arabs and Muslims should stop recognizing Israel as a state.
So far, a number of Arab states have normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The move has sparked harsh criticism among the Muslim nations.
Palestinians here stress they strongly refuse to recognize Israel and reject the normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime by certain countries. They say the resistance is ongoing and no deal can bring peace to Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The average student in the United States today leaves college with $37,000 of debt from student loans. University tuition has risen 1,200% since the late 1970s. Those younger than 24, called Generation Z, face the same prospect of expensive higher education combined with national economic stagnation since 2008. While on the campaign trail, Democrats raised major hopes with talk of an executive order canceling up to $50,000 in student debt. But President Joe Biden just declared, quote, I will not make that happen, and he will only consider $10,000 in debt relief.
Student debt is parasitic. It's very right-wing. Joe Biden isn't centrist. He's right-wing. He's always been right-wing. If this person said that he had the capability to do it, which he does, and he said he does, and he's not going to do it because it sets the wrong precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of angry people.
Such huge amounts of debt has forced the millennial class to often delay mature steps, like buying a house, investing, pursuing a graduate degree, marriage, and children. That all depresses the economy, creates more social instability and disharmony, and all the while, economic inequality skyrockets in favor of the moneylenders.
I have $28K in student debt. Under capitalism, like, college can be a very predatory thing. You're betting the rest of your life to, like, being able to make these payments. And this is going to create more distrust for the Democrats. This is going to embolden more people that might be Republican that also have a lot of student debt to not trust this person.
The student debt crisis is seemingly a uniquely American issue, but 45 million Americans owe almost $2 trillion in student debt. The immense scope of the problem seems to ensure that the nation's young adults will keep this issue in the limelight for years, or maybe even decades, until either debt relief is granted or wages massively rise. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Israeli forces opened the gates of its rainwater stores east of Gaza, allowing rainwater to flood large swaths of Palestinian land. The Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture said in a statement that the water drowned thousands of meters of agricultural lands and damaged wheat and other winter crops. This led to great financial losses for farmers.
Every year in this time, Israeli army opens the rainwater gates to flood our lands and destroy the crops. Israel also sprays harmful herbicides at our land, damaging all the farms and crops planted. These attempts aim at forcing us to leave this land. We stress that these attempts won't make us leave. We will remain here.
In violation of international standards, Israeli army also shoot at Palestinian farmers to push them off their lands and spray herbicides beside the buffer zone along the Gaza Strip, something directly affects the livelihood of Palestinians.
This is the second time in a month the Israeli army has opened its water gates and flooded our agricultural lands. All the winter crops are now destroyed here. This means a great financial loss for the farmers and even consumers. Our life as a farmer is under risk of being shot by Israeli army.
The Ministry of Agriculture says the move hampers transference of Gaza's main source of fruits and vegetables.
Over thousands of meters of our lands have been destroyed this time. Opening rainwater gates is a move by Israeli army to force us to leave our lands and damage the main food supply for Gaza. Drowning these crops would not only damage the planted crops, but also the lands.
Palestinians here say the living conditions have been deteriorating due to the Israeli blockade. They say Israel is now making the bad situation worse by damaging their agricultural lands and causing them financial losses. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
In the Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic and the residents are fearful even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India. The community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse. Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies, forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as a security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemeni
leaders have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors including health have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a lease has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
The prosecutor's office against hate crimes in Barcelona says it sees sufficient evidence to investigate Spain's far right for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims following a complaint by several Muslim communities in Catalonia. At the core of the controversy is a video published online by the nativist ultra-nationalist party Vox during the recent election campaign in Catalonia.
The video falsely claims the entire Muslim community in Catalonia is responsible for the 2017 terrorist attacks in Barcelona. It purportedly shows footage of women in burqas in mosques that was actually shot in Afghanistan and other countries.
Vox's Twitter account was temporarily suspended at the end of January for breaching the company's hate speech regulations with false accusations and unfounded claims against Muslims in Catalonia.
Their strategy is to polarize society, to create fear and manipulate that fear in order to antagonize communities. This is an old mechanism that underlines all forms of racism. It alienates others by labeling them as foreigners. It goes back centuries in the Iberian Peninsula, and that is where you need to start in order to understand the rise of Islamophobia in Spain.
Vox won 11 seats in Catalonia's regional parliament. Their aggressive campaign against Muslims has raised awareness among community leaders to re-examine their alliances.
We regret the silence of political parties in Catalonia in this election. While they all wooed Muslim voters, not a single one had the courage to stand up and denounce the Islamophobic, xenophobic attacks against our country.
Although Catalonia is home to nearly 500,000 Muslims and has elected its first Muslim female member of parliament in 2017, it does not have a central cultural center or great mosque to this day. Unlike in previous suits against the far right, representatives of the Muslim community in Catalonia say they believe they have a solid case against Vox. They trust the courts will do them justice this time around. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Across the plains of West Texas, the pump jacks that resemble giant bobbing hammers define not just the landscape, but the state itself. Texas has been built on the oil and gas business for the last 120 years, ever since the discovery of oil on Spindletop Hill near Beaumont, Texas in 1901. Texas, the nation's leading energy-producing state, seemed like the last place on Earth that could run out of energy. Then last week, it did. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Clifford Krauss, Manny Fernandez, Ivan Penn, David Montgomery, and Rick Rojas. The piece is titled, How Texas's Drive for Energy Independence Set It Up for Disaster. Stay with us for more. Across the plains of West Texas, the pump jacks that resemble giant bobbing hammers define not just the landscape, but the state itself. Texas has been built on the oil and gas business for the last 120 years, ever since the discovery of oil on Spindletop Hill near Beaumont, Texas in 1901. Texas, the nation's leading energy-producing state, seemed like the last place on Earth that could run out of energy. Then last week, it did. The crisis could be traced to that other defining Texas trait, independence, both from big government and from the rest of the country. The dominance of the energy industry and the Republic of Texas ethos became a devastating liability when energy stopped flowing to millions of Texans who shivered and struggled through a snowstorm that paralyzed much of the state. Part of the responsibility for the near collapse of the state's electrical grid can be traced to the decision in 1999 to embark on the nation's most extensive experiment in electrical deregulation, handing control of the state's entire electricity delivery system to a market-based patchwork of private generators, transmission companies, and energy retailers. The energy industry wanted it. The people wanted it. Both political parties supported it. Competition in the electric industry will benefit Texans by reducing monthly rates and offering consumers more choices about the power they use, George W. Bush, then the governor of Texas, said as he signed the top-to-bottom deregulation legislation. George W. Bush's prediction of lower-cost power generally came true, and the dream of a free-market electrical grid worked reasonably well most of the time, in large part because Texas had so much cheap natural gas, as well as abundant wind power to power renewable energy. But the newly deregulated system came with few safeguards and even fewer enforced rules. With so many cost-conscious utilities competing for budget-shopping consumers, there was little financial incentive to invest in weather protection and maintenance. Wind turbines are not equipped with the de-icing equipment routinely installed in the colder climes of the Dakotas, and power lines have little insulation. The possibility of more frequent cold weather events was never built into the infrastructure plans in a state where climate change remains an exotic, disputed concept. Deregulation was something akin to abolishing the speed limit on an interstate highway, said Edward Herz, an energy fellow at the University of Houston. That opens up shortcuts that cause disasters. The state's entire energy infrastructure was walloped with glacial temperatures that even under the strongest of regulations might have frozen gas wells and downed power lines. But what went wrong in Texas was far broader. Deregulation meant that critical rules of the road for power were set not by law, but rather by a dizzying array of energy competitors. Utility regulation is intended to compensate for the natural monopolies that occur when a single electrical provider serves an area. It keeps prices down whilst protecting public safety and guaranteeing fair treatment to consumers. Yet many states have flirted with deregulation as a way of giving consumers more choices and encouraging new providers, especially alternative energy producers. California, for example, one of the early deregulators in the 1990s, scaled back its initial foreign